Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. One of the things which I'm an avowed lover of is cities. Little did I know just some 10 years ago that there actually was a term. It's called an urbanist. And when I discovered this term, I said, that speaks to me. There's something, as far as I'm concerned, about the density of population, about residences being above shops, about historic road patterns that I just find incredibly comforting. Maybe it's because I was born in the second city of the United Kingdom. So you can imagine my shock and horror when I saw a book called The Suburb Reader by Andy Weiss and Becky Nicolaides, who have basically said that no, the suburbs literally have been the cradle of the American 20th century. At least that's my take on it anyway. So I thought, who are these imposters? Who are these people who are ripping up my notions of the one of the temples of human civilization, the city, the polis?
The attractive home of John and Margaret Bryant, the home they've always dreamed of, the happiest investment they have ever made. At last, the Bryants have all the space they need. Big floor-to-ceiling closets for each member of the family. Large, comfortable bedrooms. Zoned living areas, a feature in the plan of their home, assure convenience and privacy for various family activities. Distinctive architectural details create a lovely setting that enhance the pleasure of entertaining.
Andy and Becky, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First off, why don't you tell me how you guys know each other and why you decided to collaborate on The Suburb Reader. Becky, why don't you go first?
Yeah, sure. It's great to be here. So Andy and I actually met in graduate school when we were both working on our PhDs at Columbia University. We both had our advisor, Ken Jackson, who's sort of the godfather of suburban history. He wrote a really famous book called Crabgrass Frontier, which back in the mid-80s. So we both studied with Ken. And then we both, as we were working on our dissertations, started sort of telling an alternate history of suburbia in a way that kind of diverged from the white middle class narrative of that history. I was working on blue collar suburbs and looking at them in LA, and Andy was working on African American suburbanization throughout the country. And so we had this kind of shared interest and, you know, just developed a friendship partly around that. And we lived in International House also at the same time when we were at Columbia and became friends and sort of, intellectual colleagues as well.
Thank you. That really does start to flesh out the bones of this. Andy, what exactly is a suburb? I think everybody has an idea of what it is, but what is the definition of a suburb?
I'm so glad you asked Andy that question, not me.
I don't think there's a clearly accepted, fully accepted definition of what the suburbs are. And people have debated that for a long time. I think in the Suburb Reader, we take the position that the process of suburbanization is this outward expansion of metropolitan areas toward their fringes. The suburbs are those communities that historically were produced through that process. And so they are, you know, they may, the suburbs, historical suburbs, certainly include places that today are inside the political boundaries of a central city. And they include, you know, places that are at the far edges of metropolitan areas today. And that, you know, that pulls in a full sweep of building types and densities and landscapes, and populations. So the suburbs are that expanding portion of, you know, in our case, American cities. But in a world case, those expanding portions at the edge, those places outside the historic core.
What I understand as being like really the start of the suburbs as we understand them today is the 1920s and access to the car. How wrong am I with that assumption, Becky?
A little off historically. I mean, we are trained historians, so we push the timeline back. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we can find really early evidence of suburbia. I mean, back in ancient times, the scholars who've written about this, I think, see the roots actually in England, up in your neck of the woods, in the late 18th and early 19th century, when the upper classes wanted to escape the ills of the city and move away from the congestion and the pollution and, you know, new factories that were getting built and remove themselves from that into a cleaner green space outside of the city. And some of that exodus was class related, race related, especially class, though, I think early on, where there was a desire to kind of have distance between themselves and, you know, the lower classes of the time. And they began creating these communities in a kind of suburban ideal, you know, the beauty of nature and how that could be a healing space and a space where good Christian families could live and kind of be separated from the central city. Andy, I'm sure I'm missing a few things here.
I would just amplify that by suggesting that at that point in time, I think a lot of scholars suggest that some of the elements of a suburban ideal that we could still recognize today begin to take shape, and elements of suburban landscapes that we might still recognize today as playing really powerful roles begin to take shape. You know, including, you know, whatever, single family separated houses in the middle of yards, surrounded by, you know, by green foliage, in communities of like-minded or you know, similarly situated people, commuting to and from work, from the edge to the center, you know, are all kind of pieces of that landscape which we begin to, you know, which begin to come together in places like Clapham or Regent's Park in London. And then, you know, a set of ideas in that class of people begins to emerge as well. But we're really interested in our research, really focus on the development of alternative suburban ideals and the, you know, the multiplicity of different ideals in American and other suburban places.
Mm. I would just add too that ideal that's really starts in England migrates across the Atlantic to the United States by the mid-1800s. So by the 1850s, you see these same elite type of suburbs starting to take shape outside of New York City, some of the larger cities on the East Coast, kind of mimicking what was happening in the UK at that point. And then from there, it sort of starts out, well, I'm kind of overgeneralizing a little, but it kind of starts out as an elite ideal and would gradually trickle down to a broader cross-section of Americans who would be able to move into these peripheral communities.
I think it's interesting from a British perspective. Some of the places which you identify as being the suburbs of the day, which then have been subsumed by the city, somewhere like, let's say, Hampstead or like Kensington, etc., in London, are always in the United Kingdom to the west of the very centre, because it's prevailing wind patterns, isn't it? That because exactly what you said, Becky, that the upper classes or the more wealthy, the factory owners, wanted to build their homes away from the factories, and the winds in the United Kingdom prevailingly go from west to east. So they were away from the smog and the smell and whatever. So invariably, it's always the west sides of the central bits of UK cities, which are always incredibly wealthy. And those were the first suburbs, but then with Victorian expansion of the cities, then the cities kind of grew around them. But those pockets of affluence are still there. Obviously, what you guys have done is a whole load of work looking at the role of the suburbs within American culture. Like most great things, they start off in England, in Britain, and then they migrate over to your side of the Atlantic. So let's stay firmly in North America now. So where do we pick up the story of the suburbs pre the 20th century? Then let's go into the realm of the motor car and how America then defines itself and divides itself by this new pattern of suburban living and working. Why don't you start, Becky?
Yeah. So by the turn of the 20th century, we start seeing streetcar suburbs. That was a precursor to the automobile suburbs. So LA is a great example of this. It's a city that I know best. It's where I live, and I've studied it up and down and sideways and everything. And the streetcars, which were the electric streetcars, which were the kind of prime mode of transportation around the turn of the 20th century, were a real impetus to suburban expansion. And that happens East Coast. It happens out here in the West. And it would drive an incredible amount of decentralization and decentralized development of housing along the streetcar lines. There was a famous study of Boston that traced this out in a really great way, and it showed how the streetcars really opened up the suburbs to a much broader class range of people. So you had more kind of almost working class people that can now buy a little cottage along the streetcar line with their lace curtain and, you know, have that life on a kind of smaller scale, maybe a little cheaper scale, but have it nonetheless. So that was a really important phase of suburban development. And then, as you mentioned, of course, when the automobile comes into the picture by the early 20th century and through the 20s and 30s, the suburbs really take off. And what happens at that point is, whereas suburban development, it sort of followed the lines of the streetcar before, the automobile allowed for it to happen all over the place, that development. It allowed for infilling between those lines, because now you didn't have to rely on the streetcar to get to your house. So development started spreading like throughout entire metro areas. By that point, you know, some call them the automobile suburbs at that stage. And so you see communities of bungalows and mail order housing and sort of a whole range of kind of affordable housing, as well as wealthy housing too, at this period. And it's kind of, it sort of takes off at a greater magnitude by that point, but it still doesn't really hit peak until the next phase, which maybe I'll have Andy talk about after World War II. Unless you have another question.
I have a slight question. Yeah. And maybe this goes to some of my innate prejudice about the suburbs. But Andy, who exactly were purchased and walked into these new suburbs? So we're talking like the 1920s, when the suburban movement kind of gets rocket fueled by developers and stuff. So who were these Americans moving into these new homes?
Becky's really emphasizing, importantly, the role that technology and transportation, is playing, and the real estate developers and the industry, which, it creates the new suburbs. But two other things are, at least two other important things are happening here. And, one of those is that American cities, at least, are diversifying dramatically in the late 19th century. It's the, it's the peak era of the, the so-called new immigration, of European immigration to the United States. So central cities are becoming, hyper diverse, with 75% of the, city populations being immigrants and their children from all over Europe, especially, but really from all over the world. So you've got this intense diversification of central cities, which leads to, efforts to sort those cities out through, not just choice, but through a whole range of policies and plans that will channel people into increasingly distinct and segregated portions of the city. So who moves into the new suburbs? The new suburbs by the early 20th century are racially restricted. They're restricted by design. The new developers by 1910 or so, almost everywhere in the country, are writing race restrictive covenants into the deeds. So in order to buy a piece of property and build a home on it, you've got to, you have to be a Caucasian, as defined by the time. And, there's a range of restrictions that restrict Jews, that restrict Asians, restrict African Americans and others from purchasing in those, in those places. Some cities pick up racial zoning so that cities themselves, begin to use public authority, governmental authority to ratify those developments so that the suburbs increasingly become, and cities become increasingly segregated places. Real estate developers refuse to sell to others, or to rent to others. So we see the development of segregation in the housing market, in ways that really continue right on today, redlining and lending discrimination. Those are but one form of the new suburbs, however, and I think it's also important to recognize that before 1945, there was a working class fringe of American cities, a less regulated real estate market that focused on blue collar people, on immigrants and their children, on African Americans, developers who subdivided pieces of property that might have been downwind from the prevailing winds, places that were less advantaged, that may be economically and environmentally disadvantaged, and therefore available to wider, wider class of purchasers. And they marketed those in immigrant newspapers and labor newspapers, in African American newspapers, to those families, to buy a piece of land, get a home of your own, have a place to have chickens and a garden, a place where you'd be living in a built-up community, close to suburban work and suburban jobs. So before 1945, in contrast, I think what the stereotype is that the suburbs were, this kind of homogenous elite and white space. The pre-1945 city has got a lot more diversity. Blue-collar families are more likely to own their homes than middle-class families. They have better repayment records when they borrow money. Homeownership means something more to them than it does to white and middle class families who are moving out into the suburbs. So the suburbs are a really diverse place in the early part of the 20th century. But some of these trends towards segregation, planning, restriction are gonna get jet fuel in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, which is gonna put a halt to a lot of that diversity. And increasingly segregate the suburbs through the middle part of the 20th century.
And I think it's interesting just to note for our listeners on the podcast, and if you're viewing this on YouTube, that obviously American southern cities had historical segregated communities. But what happens in northern cities is this redlining process, isn't it? And where it becomes this kind of sometimes a secret kind of covenant, but you know, if you were Black or if you were Latino or let's say Jewish, you just couldn't purchase a property or couldn't rent a property in a certain area. So American cities then become de facto segregated as opposed to historically. In what way does the motor car actually change the look and feel of streets and of homes? So we've got the fact that we have streetcar suburbanization, then we have the motor car comes in. But there's something about those suburban streets which just, without even consciously expressing that difference, they just feel very different. So how, Becky, how does the motor car come and actually change the layout of the road, of the street?
Yeah, great question. Just to put it in context and to contrast with the streetcar suburbs, the suburban communities, like I mentioned, hugged the streetcars in a sense. And then you'd often at the station, you'd often have like a little main street area where there might be shops and maybe an apartment over the shops, a little walkable like main street area, because everything had to be within walking distance of that station. Now, when the automobile comes in, it really impacts things in a lot of different ways. At the street level, you start seeing, streets obviously built for the auto, the rise of curbs and sidewalks and driveways, the detached or attached garage would come later, but you see detached garages being a kind of design element now of a lot of suburban homes. So you had to have a place to put your car. And then you also begin to see the rise of shopping areas that are a little more oriented to the car. So maybe the earliest shopping strips along the roads, these kind of horizontally spread out, like, you know, you've seen those. I mean, those sort of the big boulevards with the shopping along them. I mean, I think that also was a function of the proliferation of automobiles at that time and how that would change cities. In a place like LA, you begin to see houses being built all over the place, up along hillsides in crazy, you know, places where obviously the streetcar wouldn't have gone before. So it opens up a lot of new land to development. It sort of puts everything, on the market as a place for possible development. And in a place like Los Angeles, it kind of creates also new vectors of class and desirability of areas. So that really elevated neighborhoods along in the hills, like the Beverly Hills and up with the views or over the beach, those become like the most coveted areas. And the automobile like sort of enabled that to happen by really opening up lots of land to development.
And Andy, as I've kind of well advertised here, I have a somewhat of a prejudice against the suburbs. I see it as somewhere where creativity and culture goes to die, right? You're going to tell me I'm completely and utterly wrong. How did this new urban phenomena or suburban phenomena go to shape mid-20th century American culture?
Well, I think one of the things that happens in the mid 20th century, you know, picks up on what both of you have just said. The automobile helps to shape a metropolitan area that's increasingly functionally, is divided into functionally separate spaces that are distant from one another, not walkable. And so, you know, the change to the street is reflected, you know, in the change to the housing landscapes, and, you know, to an extent is reflected in the changes to the political culture. You have the development of increasingly homogenous communities, and especially after World War II, you know, the federal government gets involved in a big way in subsidizing housing and stabilizing the mortgage market and making it, you know, possible for people to buy houses that they couldn't have done before.
If they're white.
If they were white, if they were white, to buy a house, you know, at a rent, at a rate that was lower than rent, right? So to make it cheaper to buy than to rent. So you've got, you know, and to make it easy for veterans, you know, of whom there are 16 million returning from the war and their families, white veterans in particular, to buy with no money down. You know, all you have to have is a job, and you can get a home loan to buy, you know, a home as long as it meets the Veterans Administration or the Federal Housing Administration criteria. And so you get the development of communities in which the experience of those people, the ages of those people is increasingly homogenous. Similar class levels, similar income levels, similar lived experiences, similar ages, you know, folks who were in their early family building stages and early childbearing years in the midst of a baby boom. And so, you know, in the mid 20th century, the 1940s and 50s suburbia, you have this, you know, dramatic expansion of a landscape that looks homogenous. It is homogenous. It's mass produced on standardized designs that are commonplace everywhere in the United States, and it's filled with folks who are about as similar as they could be in so many demographic ways, while still being all individual and different, you know, and different people with different political, you know, perspectives and the like. But it opens up the suburbs for in some particular ways, and also closes down the suburbs in some other ways. So if we talked about that more diverse, certainly ethnically diverse and class diverse suburbia of the pre-World War II period, the post-World War II period opens up homeownership for, you know, maybe a quarter of the population in the middle segment of the economy, of the economic demography of America. And huge numbers of those people are the children of immigrants. And those children of immigrants, of European immigrants who were in a indeterminate racial status in pre-World War II period, who were perceived as not quite white, become white in the post-World War II period. And so, you know, the category of those people who are perceived as white and being, you know, having access to all of the fruits and benefits of the society expands at the same time as the restrictions and the barriers and obstacles to African Americans, to Latinos, to Asian Americans are increasingly sharp and strict. And so the suburbia, you know, the suburbia of the post-war period helps to draw the color line in America much more firmly, and to do it physically in space by producing a new metropolis, which is increasingly separated into those who are white and the places where they live, AKA suburbia, and the central cities, which are more racially and ethnically diverse and are perceived increasingly as such.
Becky, what Andy is kind of led on to was exactly where I was going to go with my next question is, okay, so this is happening in the suburbs. So what then happens to the cities? When I think of the 1950s and the 60s in America, I think of the Highway Act, and I think of highways knocking down wonderful old urban neighborhoods, which invariably were poor and or immigrant, just American cities becoming disfigured by these ribbons of tarmac, because people in the suburbs wanted to drive into the cities to work and then get the hell back out. So let's talk a little bit about what then happens to the cities because of the rise of the suburbs. And then obviously we've had a certain level of white flight, but then what happens in terms of crime and law and order? You know, what is left in the center of the city because of the new rise of the suburbs?
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. so they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Burps.
Yeah, and Andy, you could jump on to this discussion. I know you're very well versed on this too. I mean, so you're absolutely right that on some level, it was a bit of a zero sum game in the 50s, 60s, 70s, especially because this was the heyday of suburbia's racialized reality, where it really had become a pretty, lily white space, quite in contrast to how things had been before, as Andy's described so well. So as the suburbs explode and they're spreading all over the place across North America, the cities are feeling the loss of tax base. They're hurt financially as people are fleeing, as you describe, as you say, and they're taking with them their tax money. Jobs are also leaving the central cities, and there's quite a bit of imbalance that we begin to see happening between like the central cities and the suburbs. I mean, this is the era of what's kind of known as like the era of the urban crisis in the U.S. when central cities become poor, they become kind of decimated by the suburban exodus, the suburbs having grasped so much of the sort of resources of the metropolis. It sort of is the making of metropolitan inequality, in a sense, where so many of the resources are getting sort of shuffled out into suburban areas and creating that inequality. And the cities suffered as a result. I mean, there was a lot of disinvestment in central cities. Some of them were going bankrupt. New York, famously, in the 70s, they were really feeling the impacts of that exodus of people, brain power, jobs, tax base, all of that, which is becoming, moving out, in a sense. Now, not to jump ahead, but things change and, things can reverse too. And they did. But at that point in time, I think it definitely suburbanization was a very important cause of the making of really vast inequality within metro areas.
I would merely amplify that if I could, just to emphasize, one critical piece here is just the money, the flows of capital that Becky's alluding to, the flows of resources are so extraordinarily imbalanced in this moment in time, both the public sector, the tax dollars, but also, the private investment into suburbia, shaped in large part by policy, by redlining policies, which, suggest where money should be invested and where it's safe to invest it and where it's not safe to invest it, which, in other words, the city, means that the suburbs are new. The suburbs are experiencing this enormous flow of money, and the cities are then engaged in a scramble of policies, many of which, are disastrous for the city and for the city populations. They, build new urban, interstate systems, freeway systems to try to, capture those suburban workers and get them to come downtown. And they drive those, 6 and 7 and 8 and, now in Southern California, 20 lane freeways, right through existing communities, typically communities of color, working class communities. They engage in processes of urban redevelopment where they build, new stadiums. They build, Lincoln Center for the Arts, the United Nations, and new civic centers like that are built on clearance sites where they have cleared the older 19th century city, typically working class and communities. And they increase hypersegregation and, disadvantage in a range of neighborhoods in the central city at the same time as those cities are experiencing this outflow of capital.
Why, when I think of the American suburb, being a Brit, I first become really aware of it in the 1980s as a teenager, and I think of I think it was Tiffany when she was singing "I think I'm alone now" in those kind of shopping malls, and it seemed to me like this was the most perfect distillation of modern America was the suburbs. It's E.T., you know, where every kid had his bicycle, had sleepovers. And these are things which Britain was hardly a developing economy, but it was like, wow, look at this perfect distillation of American culture. Why is it that great culture has not come out of the suburbs? When I think of music, invariably, I think of urban America. When I think of country music, the sound of the South, that's rural America. Other than maybe sitcoms and I Love Lucy, I can't think of a great cultural totem which you can say that's come out of suburban America. I just think of Campbell's soup when I think of suburban America. Yeah. Why is it? Yeah. Go.
Well, so two thoughts. I mean, one is like what are the suburbs, right? And so the first thing I thought of was, well, Compton, right? Compton is a suburb of Los Angeles and is a center for hip hop and worldwide culture. And this phone is produced in Cupertino and Mountain View and, in the Silicon Valley. This is a suburban, this is a suburban product. And, it's...
But isn't that... I think the example of Compton is a fair one. And I keep on holding my hand up and saying I've taken a certain amount of prejudice to this. Because when I think of the suburbs, I think of white America. And you've made... But the pair of you made the point of saying that there was non-white suburbs, directly in the pre-war period. Okay, they get squeezed out a little in the post-war period, but they were them. So I take the point about Compton. But with the iPhone, I'm not going to take that point, because that's because of Stanford. That's because of a knowledge base. And then people just they were too lazy just to move away when they graduated from Stanford. And that's the only, and that's the reason why you have Cupertino, etc. There has been definitely a move, take the COVID pandemic out of it, that those knowledge-based tech companies, that their employees wanted then, they saw the suburbs, they saw Cupertino, etc., and the peninsula has been stultifying, and then moved into San Francisco and jacked up all the prices there. So, right, because we need to start wrapping this up a little. Right. But I love a little bit of it. Intellectual argy bargy, as we say in England, a little bit of fisticuffs. Answer my point. Right. In a way which I'll see is acceptable on my podcast. Right. Why is it that great culture, not industry, because also we're talking about the phone was industry, great culture, which we can say, God damn it, that's American and that's new. That why hasn't it come out of the suburbs, considering so much money? So there was so much of a brain drain that went from the cities to there. The cities managed to still be vital on a creative level, if not economically. And now have then roared back, haven't they, in the last 20 years. Why didn't we get the equivalent for hip hop from the suburbs? Whoever wants to answer, please answer.
I think it's Becky's turn.
I think there's so much. This, first of all, that's a great question. I think there's a lot to say about popular culture and suburbia from a lot of different angles. At Exeter, University of Exeter, I might be messing the name up on that. There is an amazing group of scholars there and in the UK who study the culture of suburbia in North America as well. And I think they would beg to differ with your take on that, Roy Bill. I think they have found a lot of evidence of writing and poetry and maybe not the hip hop, but they have found evidence of a kind of vibrant culture that's come out of like the suburbs in a sense, not only in the US, but in other areas of the world too. Here's the thing though, I think about culture and suburbia. Especially right after World War II, during that explosion when the suburbs were really all over the place, the suburbia really divided America culturally, I think, into two camps. the one camp that celebrated the suburbs, and there were TV shows like Leave It to Beaver with The Ideal Family, the sitcoms that celebrated that way of life and showed this very sunny vision of American life and plenty and this comfortable life. And then there was this whole other group of people that were blasting the suburbs and criticizing them for conformity, for their shallowness, for, you know, the angst, the unhappiness. And that thread has carried forward quite a bit over time. Think about, Green Day, Jesus of Suburbia, all the cult, all of the music and you know, this angry music that sort of has been a product of suburbia, of people wanting to break out of the conformity and the sameness of these communities. It's been in some ways a really rich backdrop for a lot of cultural production, right? Where people can find their voice and their individuality. There's so many movies, like, you know, just a ton of them. There's a whole like subgenre of this kind of suburban film and TV and music that fall into that. So in some ways, maybe not in the way you're imagining, like suburbia has spawned culture in a sense, maybe a pissed off kind of culture, but it has created and generated cultural expression one way or the other.
I take that point completely, that the culture of suburbia is young adults want to get the hell out of there and stuff.
Exactly.
So I take that point. My last question. I hate shopping malls. I hate strip malls. Being British, I find them terrible. And I don't see why a key feature should be a parking lot, as you guys would define it, you know, a car park, as we'd say in the United Kingdom. In the next 5 years, I remember seeing a study, this was pre-COVID, so it's going to be accelerated now, no doubt. They said that a quarter of all shopping malls were going to close in North America. A real glib question would be, is the fate of the shopping mall emblematic of the fate of the suburbs? Right. Very obviously, a quarter of all homes in suburbs are not going to become vacant in the next 5 years. Only a lunatic would say that. But what does the death, or at least the necessary reinvention of the shopping mall, tell us about suburban living? Whoever wants to answer.
I'd love to jump in on this one. First of all, I think you're right that in some areas, the shopping mall is dying. We have a website called deadmalls.com in the U.S. that sort of document these. But I would also point out that, and this relates to how recent suburbia post-1980 has seen another resurgence of diversification. And I think this speaks to this whole controversy around suburbia that Donald Trump has raised in his discourse around this issue. But let's take the shopping mall. If you take the shopping mall, we've seen a revival of this form in Asian suburbs. So the rise of the Asian mall, where they have infused incredible life into these spaces. They are super popular. I mean, before COVID, if you went to the shopping mall near where I live, which is a heavily Asian area, packed all the time. You could not get a parking space in that parking lot. So I think with the infusion of new ethnic energy and, you know, cultural proclivities towards shopping or whatever in a certain style that might be transplanted from Hong Kong or Asia, and, you know, things are in flux and changing. And I think I don't see suburbs dying off or fading or decreasing anytime in the near future. I think if anything, the trend will continue toward their growth for better or worse. But I think it is a reflection of how suburbia itself is becoming much more of a home for a broader cross-section of Americans. And that's getting reflected in things like the shopping mall.
There you have it, folks. Right. My greatest wish is that the suburbs are banished to history. Is not to come true anytime soon. The Suburb Reader is a landmark collection of the best works on the rise of this modern social phenomena. Just very quickly, how long did it take you to pull the book together, guys?
We did a first edition in 2006, which took us a couple of years, and then we did a second edition in 2016, which was another couple of years with, you know, lots of conversations in between. So, in a couple of years in the making, but two careers really in the shaping and forming.
Again, thank you for coming on to the show. It's been utterly brilliant talking to you, jousting with you just a little and whatever. And go read it. It's a great book. Thank you for coming on to Mid-Atlantic and explaining the importance and the rise of the suburbs.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.